on Thursday, Private Healthcare Australia, which is the umbrella association covering the private health insurance industry, released two studies, which were really part of the same study, on the rise and economic impact of out-of-pocket costs and medical fees, and also the impact on individuals of this rise in medical costs. Quite dramatic. And we'll come to the details in a moment, Priya, of what these reports showed. But the quick takeaway is out-of-pocket medical costs keep on rising and are quite significant, and some people are dipping into their superannuation to pay for them.
And we did speak to a range of people about their experiences with out-of-pocket costs in the private system, and here's a glimpse of what they had to say.
It was a real shock, as well as having the existential threat of a breast cancer diagnosis I was then faced with, trying to understand and navigate healthcare costs, what the difference was between private and public, what was rebatable, what wasn't, what private healthcare covered and what it didn't cover.
I was in with a radiation oncologist within days. They really talk it through with you about how much it genuinely costs. Roughly, I would have paid upfront $17,000 to $20,000. You then get the Medicare rebate back on all of that. So you end up being roughly $5,000 out of pocket, but you still have to have $20,000 there ready to be paid.
And all these costs, I totally was not aware, going down that path of using your private health fund, that the specialist costs would be really significant. So I wiped out all my savings, and it wasn't easy to then ask my father to help me with that.
So every $50, $100, $200, $400, $75, whatever it might be, slowly adds up. The Medicare system is magnificent. You still have to outlay that money anyway, and you get a pittance back.
Yeah, so that was our house savings. Wasn't expecting to end up with cancer. I was also extraordinarily fortunate that my sister-in-law, whilst I was in hospital, went and organised a GoFundMe, and that raised roughly $25,000, which significantly helped us through the entire ordeal.
Wow, we're talking big numbers.
Yeah, it's one of the big dilemmas. I mean, a few years ago, I did a Four Corners on this called Mind the Gap, if you want to look for it. And we did a call out for people to tell us their stories. And the stories were very similar to those. And what's depressing is you've gone and made a Four Corners on this and nothing changes. In fact, it's got worse. People are suffering. People are going into their super. And in fact, going into your super probably inflates the market, because if doctors think that they can just tell you to go and get into your super, that means they can charge even more. And so our behaviour can make things worse. So I spoke to one of the authors of the study, who's an economist, Dr. Adam Triggs of Mandala Consulting, about what their research found.
The research was inspired by the cost of living crisis in Australia. And so we've been looking at what are the big structural drivers of inflation. And over the last 10 years, if you exclude things like alcohol and tobacco, which are driven by taxation, the number one driver has been healthcare costs.
I mean, that's a surprise. I mean, that's what you'd expect to hear if you're in the United States of America, but it's true of Australia as well.
It is. It's surprising, and it does sound a bit like what you would hear in America. We're seeing more people who are now traveling for medical tourism because we have out-of-pocket costs so high in some jurisdictions, like my hometown of Canberra, compared to others like Adelaide. And so we're seeing things that are much more common in America, which is people traveling for medical costs.
I did a Four Corners on this several years ago, and it doesn't sound as if much has changed. Has it got worse?
Yeah, it has. When we look across time, we can see that there is this persistent increase in inflation coming out of the healthcare sector, and we can see out-of-pocket costs continuing to rise. So at the moment, we're seeing Australian households spending about $1.3 billion every year on out-of-pocket costs, and that's been increasing steadily. And if it keeps going, it'll hit $1.7 billion by 2030.
So let's take a dive as to where the costs are and the dimensions of the out-of-pocket.
We certainly see a big difference across jurisdictions. So the average out-of-pocket costs for one procedure in Canberra is about $605. In Adelaide, it's about $228.
Which procedure is that?
This is the average across looking across a whole range of procedures. But if you were to take just one example and you were to think of, say, a hip replacement, we see that before people go into hospital, they're looking at up to $200 just for initial consultations. Once they're in hospital, they're looking at about $1,600 for the actual replacement.
This is out of pocket.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And then you've got accommodation fees of about $300, the anaesthetist of $300, and then another $200 when you're out of hospital. The difference between procedures is really stark as well. And we've heard stories where people are paying $20,000, $30,000 in out-of-pocket costs for breast cancer treatment, for example.
What about non-procedural medicine? Because you can be significantly out-of-pocket with that too.
Yeah, absolutely. We're seeing it fairly systemically across the entire journey as we map out what this looks like for different people getting different treatments. And we've done some surveys as well of a variety of people to ask them what's really driving this. And one of the core challenges they have is really just being able to compare prices across different specialists and different services.
But aren't doctors supposed to have financial consent?
Yeah. I mean, when we talk to consumers, about one in two consumers were not aware of fees prior to their appointment with specialists. We found a lot of them were under significant financial stress. We found that about 50% of them received unexpected bills for medical services. About 29% were charged administrative or booking fees, which
are illegal.
Absolutely. And so there's definitely an issue here around both just enforcing existing laws, but also having things like the Medical Cost Finder website and improving that as much as we can to try and improve this transparency so people can make better decisions.
Well, you're an economist. The argument for these transparent sites is that it actually causes inflation of medical fees in the same way as you can trace back CEO salaries going up in the general economy, having to declare CEO salaries. And one CEO sees another CEO getting 2 million and they're getting 1 million. They'll say, well, why are they getting 2 million? I'm going to charge 2 million. And when a surgeon or a physician sees a fee that is higher than theirs for the same one, they say, well, why shouldn't I be charging that? So isn't transparency in that public sense inflationary itself?
There's definitely research around CEO salaries, and I think that's an example of where it backfired. And really, that was driven by businesses making sure they wanted to be seen that they had high-paid CEOs. I don't think it really translates to this story here. I mean, what we teach our students in Econ 101 is that markets don't function without transparency.
But markets don't function in healthcare. Healthcare's market failure, as is education. So, I mean, can you even think about applying market forces to medicine?
I think you can. I mean, we have a hybrid system in Australia, which that's a combination of Medicare and a government-provided system and a private system. In both instances, but particularly the private system, we do need to make sure that we get these markets functioning well. And part of this is a supply-side issue. There's obviously big challenges in getting more specialists in, and there's a variety of things that address that. But really, a big part of this is for any market to function properly, you need to have transparency. Buyers need to be able to see all the options and all the prices and to be able to make decisions based on that.
What about price control? Successive governments have been terrified by a decision by the High Court in 1948 in relation to the Pharmaceutical Benefits Scheme. And they've assumed that that means that you cannot coerce doctors to do anything at all. Is it time to challenge that and put in cost control?
Well, I think there's a lot of things you can look at. You can look at price controls. There are things on the supply side in terms of all of the constraints that are slowing us down and getting more specialists in. I think the lens here is to think about what's the lowest hanging fruit. And in my mind, it's going to be things like transparency, and it's going to be things like enforcing existing laws around misleading and deceptive conduct and making sure that we're getting those basics right.
How do you explain the differences between cities?
We don't see the number of specialists alone being the core driver, which tells you that there might be more of sort of cultural issues at play here and other factors that are driving some of these differences. They're just too stark to be explained by just looking at the number of specialists.
When you challenge specialists about this, they say, well, if the government were to increase the Medicare rebates, we'd be much happier. But what I remember a few years ago, they did that with obstetrics. And all that did was increase the cost in obstetrics. I think it was under Tony Abbott. There was a rebate when you got to a certain amount. And all that happened is that the obstetricians just charged up to that amount and increased their income. Where do Medicare rebates sit within this? Because, I mean, we have to say this research is sponsored by Private Healthcare Australia, which is the overarching organisation for the private health insurance industry. And they would say their rebates are tied to the Medicare rebates.
Yeah, that's correct. And really what we've got here is more of a structural challenge around, and we can see this over time, that this isn't a new thing. This has been something that's been building up and is continuing to build. And so the concern with the rebate and increasing that is that not only you potentially just see that getting absorbed into prices, but it ends up adding more into the inflationary pressure here as well.
Have you looked at the income levels of the specialists? So, for example, anecdotally, I hear in orthopaedic surgery, you've got young orthopaedic surgeons coming in and the business isn't there in the same way as it used to be. Is that expectation of salary or income, how does that play into this?
Again, if you go back to thinking about this as a market and you think about, well, how competitive is the market and what are people's ability to increase prices? Whatever your expectations are, if you have a transparent market where people can shop around, if you've got strong competition and you've got lots of different options, well, then those sort of expectations shouldn't really be able to flow through the system anyway.
So when you've done this research, you've also looked, apart from the economic side, you've looked at the impact of consumers. What are the key findings there?
What we found is about 1.2 million consumers will delay or avoid accessing specialist care by 2030. So this is an additional 330,000 people who are delaying accessing care from 2024. We know that young people in particular are more likely to do this. So another 10,000 young people will be avoiding specialist care because of rising costs by 2030. We can see this in other areas as well. So we know in superannuation, for example, there was more than $1 billion withdrawn in 2024, which if you track that through means that by the time someone retires, they've lost about $48,000 in their super account. So there's a really big concern here around a false economy that we're seeing these short-term impacts, which are going to have these very big long-term consequences.
Can you give us your top two or three policy recommendations here for government?
I think transparency is the main recommendation here. We've got the Medical Cost Finder website, which is an opportunity for consumers to get on there and to look at what are the different options available to them and to be able to shop around. But we do have a bunch of problems with that that can be improved. So one option is to have an opt-out system for specialists, and that would boost the amount of data that's in the system. We can add patient reviews and quality metrics to the system. We can support GPs with a referral tool to show specialists in their local area by price to patients so that they can make more informed decisions as well. There are other things we can do to increase the supply of specialists that are both being trained and able to come into the country. But I think in terms of the fastest things that we can do and those lowest hanging fruit, we'll be looking at transparency in particular.
Dr. Adam Triggs of Mandela Consulting.
I find this extremely interesting. I think as both a doctor, and I have to declare that my husband is a plastic and reconstructive surgeon as well. So we have these kinds of discussions at home all the time. I do think, Norman, that the reasons for the rising out-of-pocket costs are really multifactorial and really quite complex. And I often refer patients to the private sector because the public system is completely overwhelmed. They're often going to wait 18 months for an appointment. And so I give patients the option, and some people will go, you know what, for my cervical cancer screening test finding, I need a colposcopy. I'd rather get that done soon. I'll go and see someone privately and accept the cost. So I think some of it is that the public system is extremely overwhelmed, and we actually have to work on improving access there, which I know is, you know, a lot of think tanks and people are working on that. But I also don't think it is necessarily, I think there are some practitioners who definitely either surgical or physician. I think some of them are perhaps, you know, it is a greed issue. We have to acknowledge that.
Well, it's hard to justify a $20,000 to $30,000 out-of-pocket for a prostatectomy.
I agree.
Which in Melbourne, you could be $500 to $1,000 out-of-pocket, depending whether you live in Canberra, Sydney or Melbourne. I mean, you cannot blame, for example, your Medicare rebate being low when you're charging thousands, and some are.
When it's that huge discrepancy, I 100% agree with you. I think for some specialties, like I know a lot of neurologists who will spend an hour with the patient doing a full assessment examination, and it's a complex consult, it needs an hour, and the rebate doesn't necessarily reflect that complexity. And so I explain to patients, you know, this is why the cost is, this is what to expect.
And another example is pediatricians who are developmental pediatricians who do, say, an assessment of a child for autism spectrum disorder. You've got to do extra training to do the assessment. Then you've got to do the assessment, which takes a long time. And as with ADHD, you've got to assess teachers and other people around the child. Then you've got to write the report. Mm. It could be 3 hours' work, for which
the rebate just doesn't do it.
No, was the rebate $180 or something like that?
So I think we really need to openly admit that this is complex. I'm not sure that I agree with Adam that the Cost Finder website is necessarily going to improve things and help with, you know, maybe some transparency, but will it fix the issue? And one patient who spoke to us, Greg, had some comments on that as well.
If fees could be signposted, more accessible, that'd be a great idea. But whether that actually makes the situation better, I doubt it. What needs to happen is for the Medicare benchmark payments have not kept up with the actual health issues and costs.
The other issue here is, where I disagree with Adam, is he seemed to believe, maybe it coincides with what you're thinking, Priya, is that medicine operates like a market, and it doesn't.
It doesn't.
It is not. There's market failure. And the reason there's market failure, and it just comes to its transparency, is there's what's called in economic terms information asymmetry. The reason that we have rules about advertising and truth in advertising is that you want to know when they say something about the fridge you're about to buy that it's true, and you can compare one car to another. It's hard. It's very hard, but at least there's more information about cars than your medical care. So I, as a doctor, know a lot more than you. And if I say to you, I need to see you three times over the next 3 weeks, or you need this operation, who are they to say no? And what doctors are able to do is generate income. So this is what's happening. Let's take orthopedics, for example.
Okay.
There's less knee surgery to be done, but you want to maintain your income. So what some orthopedic surgeons are doing is they're splitting down platelets and giving you a platelet injection. What other orthopedic surgeons are doing is that they're finding something wrong with your hip.
Or charging you more for the actual procedure to make it up. But can I say about this Cost Finder website? What happens, Norman, when you log on and go, oh, well, my gap fee for a carpal tunnel and I'm a subspecialised hand surgeon is a couple of hundred. This person's quoting $10,000.
And people will think the quality is higher because it's $10,000 and there is no relationship between quality and the fee charged.
And they do, Norman. I've had patients say to me, but Priya, isn't that too cheap? I really want the best person here. The cost doesn't necessarily reflect someone's knowledge. And often the people who are really, really good at their job aren't charging these exorbitant amounts. I think as a GP, I'll quite enjoy the site for being able to compare and actually talk to patients when I'm referring, because it's really hard, Norman, to know what people are charging.
And you know, there is the issue of bill shock and what Adam was talking about there, which was booking fees, is that you turn up and these could be surgeons or procedural specialists who've done a deal with the health insurer that they will charge no gap or known gap. And then you find they're charging a booking fee. And that is actually, some people would argue, illegal.
You know, and talking about this bill shock, we had someone speak to us, Luan Lawrence-Woods, who in 2020 had a breast reconstruction combined with gynecological surgery. And she got quotes from both surgeons and it was eye-opening.
On the day of my surgery, which was 8 months after the quote, in the pre-op room, I was introduced to the gynae surgeon's assisting surgeon, who I didn't even know would be there. And I was like, oh, hello. So that's the first time that I met that assisting surgeon. That's the first time that I heard that I would be needing one. And at that point, you know, you're really nervous. You're in the pre-op room and you're meeting somebody that you're thinking, oh, my gosh, I'm probably going to get a bill for that later. But I didn't know about that. And I did. I was out of pocket $570 for something that I wasn't expecting and I hadn't been told about.
Women's health advocate Luan Lawrence-Woods. Hayley also experienced substantial costs in relation to breast cancer treatment, but it was complicated for her because she was living regionally.
It was only because I had access to accommodation that I could travel up to Brisbane and stay up there for treatment. I live regionally. I am a single parent, but I've chosen to go down the having private health cover. You forego other things in your life to afford those expenses, but the shock of the gap that you pay is quite shocking.
So given everything that we're hearing, Norman, we decided to speak to someone who is a physician who could perhaps provide us with some more insight. That person was Professor Jennifer Martin, who's a clinical pharmacologist and the president of the Royal Australasian College of Physicians.
Well, I think it's complex. I think I just wanted to start by saying that the RACP, our college, does not set or recommend fees. and does not support exorbitant or unreasonable fees. The complication we have is that a lot of patients now have a lot of chronic issues. So you might go to a gastroenterologist because you think you might like a scope. And when you get to the gastroenterologist realizes that actually you've got a whole lot of other medical issues, including sometimes mental health issues that need to be sorted out. So whilst you can bill for the consultation, the Medicare rebate for a complex consultation as our population ages and has more chronic medical issues hasn't kept pace.
I agree with that, Jenny, but it's certainly not, I think, the whole picture, because there is a real discrepancy, isn't there, in what people can actually charge. Someone might charge $400 and someone else might charge $800 or $1,000. Do you think that transparency and the Cost Finder website is going to help?
Yes, and the College of Physicians certainly supports financial transparency. I think it's really important to note, though, that the setting of fees is complex. Fees should definitely align with community and professional standards of fairness and reasonableness. I think it'd be interesting to actually have a look at the fees that oncologists are charging in a regional centre or rural centre as opposed to a metro centre. And I think that's contributed to by the different costs that professionals in different jurisdictions might encounter.
I mean, there are two or three issues here. One is people think if they're paying a lot of money, they're getting better quality, and that's absolutely not true.
Correct.
And secondly, we've got no idea. I often say we focus on surgeons for this sort of thing, you know, how much you're spending for, because it's easy to measure quality in surgery. Do you get an infection? Do you die in 30 days? Adam's talking about transparency. And one of the things about transparency is quality. And we've got no idea whether one oncologist is better than another, whether one endocrinologist is better than another. There's no monitoring. And that is your area. That is the area of the College of Physicians, is about quality and standards.
Correct. That is our remit. You're correct in the sense that when we have followed our physicians, that we are comfortable that they are all practicing at that high standard. What subsequently happens with people in the public system is that we can actually see each other and what they're doing. I think in the private system, that might be more difficult to oversee.
I do think, though, a lot of this falls to, as a referrer, as a GP, I think it falls to people like us doing a lot of work in the consulting room. And I do think transparency there in terms of fees and perhaps quality, what you're talking about, Norman, might be quite useful. And patient reviews, which Adam mentioned as well. I just wonder, Jenny, do you think that strengthening the public system is part of the solution here? Because I know a lot of people turn to private because the public waiting list, particularly for non-procedural things, so seeing an endocrinologist or a neurologist, are so long. The public system is so burdened. Is that part of the problem, and what's the solution there?
Yes, I think that that's a really good point, because I think we're really focusing on fees, and fees alone won't fix the affordability or the access issue, or indeed the issue that you've raised, Norman, which is around quality. And how do you know that somebody, once they're off practicing in private, is actually meeting standards? So the public health system is an issue. And I note the recent injection of funds from the Albanese government. However, that's really got to address the workplace shortages.
One of the solutions put forward in this report is increasing supply, particularly in rural areas. There's been controversy with the College of Surgeons over many years that they just don't have enough training positions in rural areas. And what's known is that if you train in a rural area, you're much more likely to stay in a rural area. And also relaxing the rules to some extent on people coming in with specialist qualifications, non-GP specialist qualifications from overseas. What's the College of Physicians' position on both?
If I can focus on the first question, which is support in the regional, rural and remote areas, our college has put a significant amount of work into this and working with state and Commonwealth governments on how we actually attract people to train there and what the college can do to actually support people training in the regional areas. If we train people in the regions, they tend to stay there. So previously, we couldn't do that within our college because people had to go into the metro sites to be signed off by a senior physician. We've just actually approved and we've launched actually our first lot of physician trainees who can do all of their training in a regional area in WA. In terms of supporting people from overseas to come and work in Australia, we've always had a very strong overseas training program for overseas physicians. And we did support also the discussions around supporting overseas people to come and to go out to regional sites, noting that for a lot of practitioners that come in from overseas and go into regional sites, it's quite daunting for them. And often they leave those regional sites within a short period of time because they don't feel well acculturated and supported in those sites. So we were quite dismayed, I think, to see that the government was then not requiring them to be part of the college and not requiring them to be acculturated into the Australian system and actually enabling them to set up straight away within the metro site. So not only are these people not supported in a network of specialists, but they're actually not required to go to the regional setting. So we're not really sure what benefit this is providing, A, to their practitioners, or B, to the needs that we have in the regional and remote workplaces. And we're also concerned because the whole acculturation issue is not covered because these people don't have the supervision and they don't have the oversight of standards that they have in our current OTP pathway.
That was Professor Jennifer Martin, who's the president of the Royal Australasian College of Physicians.
And we'd welcome your comments. Just email us at healthreport@abc.net.au. We have had a response from the Medical Oncology Group of Australia, who represent medical oncologists. These are the non-procedural people who look after you when you've got cancer. And we'll have that response on our website.
I think we couldn't have this discussion, Norman, without at least touching on psychiatry. But it is bound by a different college, so different to physicians and surgeons. I think a lot of people are shocked that they might be paying for private health insurance, but when they go and see a psychiatrist for either a mood disorder, ADHD assessment, an eating disorder, the private health doesn't necessarily cover the out-of-pocket costs for the consult, for the outpatient consult. And I have seen a real spectrum of what people are charged. It could be $800. It could be $2,500.
$2,500?
And for a lot of patients, Norman, going through the public system when it comes to psychiatry is...
Oh, it's a disaster.
...really difficult. That's why a lot of people go privately and then there are huge out-of-pocket costs. So, look, I think we have tried to cover this as best we can, acknowledging that it's a very complex issue and hopefully we've done it justice.
And you're with the Health Report, which probably only costs you a few cents for your taxation on ABC Radio National.